Blog Talk Radio.
Rah. Killer Mike Bamboo. You already know. Yeah. No surprise, I'm from a gangbang culture, but we can keep it civil or pull a thang-thang on ya. Southern California where the sun don't quit, intergenerational gang so sons don't quit. But immediately you see that the problems that's in my city are secondary to what's propelling it in my city. I mean really break it down, take poor black and brown, educate them poor, take the jobs from out the town. Then inundate them with the date of drugs and dumb TV, locked into a zoo and hunted daily by the police. Then you get a group of youth who know they don't belong, then they gather up and organize a number up strong. But see, the failure isn't seeing that the problem ain't the gang, it's the situation in the communities where we hang. So I'm so pro-gang, it might scare a motherfucker, cause I fix the misconception that the enemies are brothers.
Bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, upset the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, bang on the setup, homie, we been set up.
I tell them, I went from a street gang thing, then I joined a military fleet marine force thing. From a little bitty gang in the south of Los Angeles to dragging bodies out of their house to help a government who hell bent on keeping money spent on the missile. The reality's the difference between them shits is little. We had the objective of arming up over money, and they had the objective of arming up over money. And we told kids join us, we the truth. Lies about protecting our black to get recruits. Then we found out we getting killed for a hood, and we don't own a single speck of dirt on that hood. Whether in a zone down south in Decatur, or in a flatlands off of Lenox and La Brea, or in a low-rise project in Chicago, big money come in and buy up our body.
So your sets up, we about to upset the setup. We about to upset the setup. Up to upset the setup. Throw your sets up, we about to upset the setup. Upset the setup. Up to upset the setup.
I do it for the Crips and the Blooders, BGF brothers, the real Freeway Ricky Ross and Chris Dutters. I do my thing for Hoover. I represent for four. So my folk and my people, so they set to support. Support a mean Matthew. She might say the shot. So maybe next summer, no mama's gotta cry. Cause maybe next summer, nobody gotta die. Hell, even if we fail, somebody gotta try. The only way the system rule is somebody gotta lie. And the lie they told is old. They base it on your race. They separate you black, you brown, you yellow and white face. Then we further separate by joining gangs and legislate. That our neighborhoods are now at war like we are separate states. So the police occupy our hood to keep down all the drama. So the Starbucks they just built is comfortable for Black Mama. And American Apparel comfortable for all the hipsters. And it's zero tolerance for all you spicks and you niggas and you chinks and you crackers. And it ain't about who's whiter and it ain't about who's blacker, but the money is a factor. And the factor is the factor. We've got moved up out the hood. When starvation is present and absent is a job, a man with simple thoughts, or he will form a mob. If you should form a mafia, then you should think Sicilian. Buy the hood for real. Every block, every field, every bill, every bill. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. Feel, feel. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Feed the chill, feed the chill. Gang bang, gang bang. On the system. On the system.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. The struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mitch Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret.
Jordan from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free land. Real sure ingredients. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Bumani Shakir, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal, to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal, to transfer the criminal mentality to the new African mentality, and that's on through educational means. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. We want to build a new African nation. Our fifth goal, to prepare a new African prisoner for release, produce new African recidivism. We had a whole different type of mentality in general, you know, transferring our brothers and sisters into a more productive people so we can build this nation. I'd like to thank everybody who's been following our broadcast in 2014. I'd like to thank everybody who currently educating themselves and currently doing the work in their respective communities. I'd like to send a shout-out to all the new African political prisoners, catching new African citizens, all the political prisoners from the various movements, the Black Liberation Movement, the Pan-African Movement, so forth and so on, and all the ones who continue to do the work by creating programs, institutions, writing books, designs, and mentoring younger brothers and sisters to do for a better purpose in life. You know, before I bring in our guest tonight, I'd like to go up a couple of events that happened in history during this week. Okay. On November 27, 1957, Dorothy Height, YMCA official, was elected president of the National Council of Negro Women. In 2000, in a continued uproar over racial profile of persons with their turn driving by a black, document released in New Jersey indicated that at least 8 of every 10 car searches by state troopers on a New Jersey turnpike in the last 10 years involved minority drivers. In November 28, 1960, novelist Richard Wright, author of Native Son and other books, died in Paris, France at the age of 52. On November 29, 1780, Lemuel Haynes, Revolutionary War veteran, licensed to preach in the Congressional Church. 1887, Granville T. Woods, patented induced telegraph system. In 1950, Mamanakua Njeri born. Mamanakua Njeri is late widow of Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., member of the Chicago Black Panther Party, the mother of Fred Hampton Jr. I mean, she's the widow of Chairman Fred Hampton and the mother of Fred Hampton Jr. She did recently had a birthday. In 1961, Freedom Riders attacked by a white mob at bus station in Macomb, Mississippi, for last November 29, December 2nd. In 1997, Coleman A. Young, the first new African mayor of Detroit, died in Detroit at the age of 79. On November 30, 1869, James Lynch elected Secretary of State in Mississippi contest. In 1912, Gordon Parks, filmmaker, photographer, and artist was born. In 1924, Shirley Chisholm was born. Shirley Chisholm was the first new African woman elected to Congress in 1968 and the first new African woman to run for president. In 1950, Chairman Larry Hoover was born, who was a new political prisoner. Chairman Larry Hoover was once a part of the Pontiac Brothers, was a political cage that lasted from 70 to 81, and they all put on death row. And the main people that got them out death row were people like New African Attorney, and Chairman of NAPO, New African People Organization, Baba Choka Lumumba, and also active NAPO member, MAJ member right now, founding member, Baba Dr. Kwame Kamala, and also a lot of them Pontiac brothers who came from different organizations, street organizations from the Vice Lord, GD, Stones, so forth and so on. A lot of brothers are conscious new African citizens, as well as Larry Hoover himself and Jeff Ward. In 1956, Floyd Patterson, 21, knocked out Archie Moore in the fifth round and became the youngest fighter to win the World Heavyweight Boxing Championship. In 1966, Barbados gained independence. Yes, sir, free the land, Barbados. December 1st, 1862, in his State of the Union message, President Lincoln called for 3 constitutional amendments on slavery, including a proposed 15th Amendment for the deportation of new Africans. He did not mention his proposed Emancipation Proclamation. 1873, the 43rd Congress from 1873 to 1875, convened with seven new African congressmen, Richard H. Kane, Robert Brown Elliott, Joseph H. Rainey, and Alonzo J. Rainzer out of South Carolina, James T. Rapier, Alabama, Josiah T. Walls, Florida, and John R. Lynch, Mississippi. In 1955, Rosa Parks refused to give her her seat on a segregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama. 1987, James Baldwin died. On December the 2nd, abolitionist John Brown was hung. In 1895, the 54th Congress, well, after 1895-1897, was convened. One new African congressman, George W. Murray, from South Carolina. In 1953, Dr. Rufus Clement, president of Atlanta University, elected to Atlanta Board of Education. In 1992, president-elect Bill Clinton asked poet Maya Angelou to compose and read a poem at his January inauguration. On December 3rd, 1847, Frederick Douglass published the first issue of his newspaper, The North Star, in Rochester, New York. In 1861, annual admission to Congress, prepared to our State of the Union address, President Lincoln warned against radical anti-slavery initiatives and urged Congress to take steps to colonize Negroes at the same time, a place in a climate congenial to them. In 1864, 25th Corps, largest all-new African Union history U.S. Army, established in the Army of James. 1867, Virginia Constitutional Convention. 25 new African, 80 whites, met in Richmond. Because of political and legal complications, the Virginia Constitution was not adopted until July 6, 1869. In 1883, the 48th Congress, the letter from 1883-1885, convened. Two new African representatives, Jane E. O'Hara, North Carolina, and Robert Small, South Carolina. Also, December 30, Human Rights Day. In 1964, J. Raymond Jones, elected leader of the New York Democratic Organization, known as the Tammany Hall. 1988, Barry Sanders of Oklahoma State University won the Heisman Trophy. In 2000, poet Gwendolyn Brooks died in Chicago at the age of 83. Also on December 3rd, Frederica Newton was born. Frederica Newton was the late widow of Dr. Huey P. Newton. She also won the founders of the Huey P. Newton Foundation along with David Hilliard, and she also was a member of the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Those are a couple of events that happened in history during this week. You know, it's a lot more, but those are just a few. You know, I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Cyro Oboya, for the opening brother lineup right quick, a.k.a. known as Big Mel. Big Mel. Big Nail, the opening brother lineup right quick. Free line, brother. You there?
Peace, bro. Zalut. I'm here, man.
Peace. Yes, sir. Zalut, brother. Okay. First of all, brother, thank you for coming to our broadcast. I'm sure you're not doing the standing. But thank you for the work you're doing in the past, present, and the future. And before you pop this out, tell the people a little bit about yourself, where you from, who you are, things like that, so they can get acquainted with who you are before we jump into this.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And first of all, man, I want to say thank you for having me, man. I appreciate you inviting me on the show, giving me an opportunity to really build with the fam. I look at opportunities like this as not only opportunities for me to maybe parlay some information to somebody who may or may not have had it, but also, too, to learn, you know, from you and anybody else who engages with us this evening, man. So thank you for that. In terms of me, man, like, it's interesting you mentioned this week having to do with some of the street organizations, otherwise called gangs in Chicago, man. I'm originally from Chicago. And, you know, I grew up in sort of the remnants of that consciousness in this shot, man. A lot of people from Chicago, we know all about, like, Black liberation movements, and we know about, you know, the different Black organizations, Black Panthers, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Chicago itself was founded by a Haitian revolutionary, Jean-Baptiste Pomp du Sable. So we know all about that, but you know, the reality of our lives on the day-to-day in Chicago, man, is like, man, it's violence. It's this gang culture, street culture, and a lot of that comes with just negative context. So what happens, man, is, you know, when you are in that environment, it makes it difficult to really become as active as you may have been in, you know, otherwise. You see what I'm saying? I'm sure you're familiar with the trope of the black student, the black boy or the black girl that is going to school and he's smart, he or she is smart, and they're like absorbing all the information, but all the other kids in the school are making fun of them, you know, calling them a nerd and stuff like that. I was kind of that guy. Yeah. You see what I'm saying? So just to kind of set the scene for you, man, like I grew up knowing and understanding that like my understanding of the world was different from others, but I sort of had to adapt. I had to adapt to the environment I was in, being that it was, you know, street oriented. And, you know, by the age of 12, I got jumped into the gang. So, you know, I was active, you know, gang banging, everything that comes with that. I won't glorify it, so I won't go too deep into that. But I was blessed, man, where my mom, she knew better than allow me to sort of grow up in that environment and took us out of Chicago. So I moved to the South in my teenage years, which eventually had me come over to Atlanta, a.k.a., you know, Top City, New Africa. So I'm here now. I'm based in New Africa, based in Atlanta. Primarily, what a lot of people may know me is from, like, my hip-hop, like, my music. Like you mentioned, my name is Big Nail. I have music online that anybody can go check out at this point, from my first album, which is the Black Power album, to my different mixtapes and all the other artists that I've worked with, so on and so forth in that regard. The most recent project that I dropped was the Run It Back Volume 2 mixtape, Revolutionary Black Gangster mixtape. And that was along with some of my comrades. I'm sure you know about Malik Kalam and Zaid Malik. So those comrades, they really helped me. Outlaw RBG, man, and really helped me to have like a cadre of like-minded brothers and sisters, because it was sisters down with the movement too, but like-minded folks who can really vibe with me, because that particular movement, like you mentioned, Outlaw RBG, that's about us being able to connect with the streets, but also connecting the revolutionary consciousness and the mindset with the streets. You know what I mean? Understanding the different revolutionary concepts that we have. Sometimes it's difficult for younger folks on the streets to really be able to relate to it. It can go over their head at times. So Outlaw RBG, that movement was designed to be able to make revolutionary consciousness more palatable to the streets. So, you know, with Outlaw Radio, working with Malik Kalam, we're able to reach out to folks, not only, you know, in the free world, but also behind the walls. In addition to that work, the music, though, I'm kind of like a hip-hop scholar, because at around the same time that I came into consciousness with my hip-hop and sort of transitioned into doing revolutionary and conscious hip-hop, I also really delved into becoming a scholar. So a lot of my research at the time was looking at black social movements, youth movements, and how hip-hop can be used as a tool to sort of push forward the next black social movement. So a lot of my research is in that vein. Along with that came working in communities, working with youth organizations, working with schools, just youth enrichment stuff, gang intervention stuff, dealing with community organizing, getting people politically educated, you know, doing like the political education stuff in the different communities. And it's funny too, because in doing that, man, I found another passion of mine, which is teaching. So, you know, I've had the opportunity to really enrich young people's lives as a teacher, delving into teaching, because my specialty as a teacher is history. So I teach world history, U.S. history, cultural anthropology, economics, and martial arts in school. So, you know, I was able to really provide a very strong foundation in the humanities in the schools that I taught at. And just to give you an example, you know, a lot of times we talk about U.S. history. U.S. history tends to start off with the Pilgrims. I start off talking about the Moors. You know, talk about thank heaven for 7-Eleven, because if it wasn't for the Moorish influence on the early European settlers that come to the U.S., a lot of that Moorish influence is what the identity of America is now. We just don't know our own history to be able to know it. So it's great to be able to shine that light to students who would look at U.S. history and not see themselves, and by the end of the year, they do see themselves, and they're able to not only be able to see themselves, but also to fully represent themselves in the history of America. So, you know, I'm blessed to have that opportunity. Just to give a little bit more background, I've worked with organizations like Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. I've worked with WADU, the World African Diaspora Union. I worked with Let Us Make Man. With Let Us Make Man, not only did I do security, but also I did some presentations. One of them was a workshop called Gangs, Cliques, and Crews that I actually created. And that particular workshop was designed to educate the people about the history of gangs and how really gangs came out of the Black Liberation Movement, sort of the remnant for that. You know, when you think of the Black Panthers, when you think of the US organizations, when you think of SNCC and all those different organizations of young people who were fully active, like fully engaged in liberation activity in the 60s and into the 70s, what happened in the 70s is you began to see a level of repression that can only be compared to how colonial nations deal with their colonies. Like you think about like some of the stuff that happened in the Congo and things of that sort. A lot of that could be compared to what happened to us in the U.S. during the 70s in reaction to what we were doing in the 60s and really waking up brothers and sisters in the Black Liberation Movement. So that going into the 80s, from the 70s to the 80s, you start to see, you know, drugs get involved, and it really kind of changes the tone of what these organizations become, and they become more of a cancer to the community as opposed to a help. And that's where you really see gangs sort of emerge in our community. So just giving that educational perspective, but also helping parents and helping community leaders have the confidence to be able to help young people that they're involved with to keep them away from getting involved with gangs now. Because nowadays, I mean, if you think about it, the only reason why anybody would join a gang is because they don't have a family. They don't have like a peer group that they can look to and feel confident that they are safe and they're protected. So they have to form these alliances with these gangs. And a lot of these gangs now have become more of like they use these young people. They're not really providing like the safety and the camaraderie that it used to be. It's more so using them to commit crimes because they're too young to really get felonies and so on and so forth. You and I, we all know how that goes, but I digress.
Yes,
just to kind of wrap it up a little bit, because I know I'm talking a lot about my background, and I kind of feel like a bragging, but, you know, I really just want to give a full foundation of who I am. Because sometimes people, they hear my name and they see me and they know me as the rapper. Or some people know me as, like, my students didn't know I rap because I didn't really push that toward them. So I just want to give a full understanding to the audience of what I do, man. Nowadays, man, I recently actually went through the Man Heal Thyself Wellness Warrior program with Supernova Sloan and Queen Afua. And that has really put a different perspective in everything that I've been involved in. It's allowed me to bring everything into culmination to now work on becoming a full version of a man. And not only that, but you know, my wife and I, we recently had a son. And my work now, you know, as it is, you know, for the time being, of course, it always will sort of adapt. My work now is to create the prototype of how to raise a son properly as a new African in this context of America that we live in now, man. So, you know, I'll just leave it at that, and we can sort of, you know, cross more stuff as we converse, you know.
True indeed, and I appreciate that. No, the first question I wanted to ask, what exactly does your name mean? You know, what where it come from, what's the origin of it, what it mean?
Man, I appreciate that question, man. So my name, my full name is Thairu Chibwana Obuya. Now, like the Most High, like the Creator, I have many names. So Thairu is my New African name. It was actually given to me by my mentor and some of the people he worked with, in particular, Akinyele Umoja, Dr. Akinyele Umoja, Baba AK, as we like to call him. He was my mentor, man, and he really helped me to sort of formulate my worldview, not only as an artist, but how to communicate my artistry in a way that helps to communicate, you know, revolutionary consciousness to our people. So Thairu is a Swahili name, which means rebellious or anti-authoritarian. Because to be honest with you, man, like my forward personality is I don't really give a fuck about what you say. I'm going to do what I feel like needs to be done. Like I'm a freedom fighter. You see what I'm saying? I'm a freedom fighter regardless of what. And that's why they gave me that name. Kibwana is sort of a name that was given to me to help me refine myself in that. So Kibwana means young gentleman. And Obuya is born when the garden is overgrown. So it tells a story. The rebellious, anti-authoritarian young gentleman born when the garden is overgrown. So that's my name. That's what it means. And Big Nail is sort of a name that I started using when I first got into rap. You know, the B-I-G is... It's not just like big in terms of like, you know, large, but the B-I-G stands for Black in Glory. So I look at myself as a shining light of blackness, so to speak. So that's the long and short of it.
Okay. True indeed. I appreciate the information. I know you said that you work with various organizations, like from the UNIA, ACL, MAGM, WADU. That's right, man. Are you a part of any of those organizations?
Yeah, I'm still a member of UNIA ACL. That's lifelong for me because, you know, that work is lifelong work. In terms of MHGM, I'm still a part of them as well. I'm just not active. I'm not as active as I was before because when I was fully active with MHGM, I was a student. I was an undergrad student at Georgia State University. Excuse me. Now that I'm a father and a husband, you know, I can't be as active on that level. I have to be more of an advisor. So, you know, from time to time, I am actually available to provide security and training in terms of martial arts and self-defense to folks whenever MHGM needs it. So that's sort of my role now. With WADU, I'm not as active with them. I do still have connections with them. I just haven't been active with them. I'm gonna be honest with about that. I do have an affiliation with them, so whenever you know the opportunity does present itself, and that's something I definitely would be involved with. But the main thing when it comes to organizations is my role in the organization is always been a servant. Like I don't want to join the organization to become the leader and to really gain like notoriety as the man in this group. More so for me is I see us needing to get free. We need to be liberated, not just physically but mentally more so, because I think the biggest hurdle for blacks in America, new Africans or, you know, Moorish people, whatever you want to call us, the biggest hurdle for us is the mental parameters that we put around ourselves. What we conceive for ourselves to be able to do. And that kind of goes into a lot of the work that I've been doing in terms of my recent scholarly work. I've really been looking at this whole concept of black political thought in America. So I think black political thought in America, it sets the tone for how to have conversations around what liberation looks like. Because if you ask, let's say, for example, you meet a black man who grew up in affluence, like his family wasn't necessarily rich, but, you know, he didn't want for nothing, right? Had both parents at home, great education, grew up around, you know, a diverse group of people, black people, white people, you know, Asian, Latin, all otherwise, had all of those experiences. The way they see black people getting free would be way different than the way that you and I may see it. Because in their mind, they're like, well, we just need to vote, or we just need to do this, we just need to do that. And their consciousness may be informed differently based on their experience. So I think a lot of times, if we're able to really have more informed conversations about stuff like that, that'll allow us to be able to break down hurdles where we're not just looking at each other and saying, hey, brother, you're wrong because this is what it's supposed to be. This is the answer. There is no one answer. The answer is how do we, like, the real answer starts with the question of how do we find a way to have a common ground amongst all of our different levels of political thought. So I know that was kind of a long, you know, trail away from the original question about the organizations, but to be honest with you, man, just to be cool, just to be real with you, like, you know, I look at organizations as a means to an end. So I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm in an echo chamber and I'm only adhering to what one organization or what frame of reference looks like when our people are too diverse for that. I need to be able to find ways to at least communicate with other different types of brothers and sisters so that we can create the conversation that's going to lead to our eventual liberation.
Indeed. You know, you asked a question in a good way, express yourself, because, you know, that based on how I met you. I remember when I met you at the Malcolm X Festival and you were doing security then, you know, and I was like, okay. I'm going to have a conversation with your brother, see what's happening with him, you know, and we maintain communication over the years, you know. So I'm like, okay, yeah. Everything good. You know, I remember we had a conversation and you were talking about the new African nation. You were talking about in regards to being a new African. You feel like every new African should be able to be trained. It's like on a combat warfare and defend themselves. And you said it wouldn't be right if a new African wasn't trained. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, certainly, man. And I appreciate you allowing me to even go into elaboration about that, man. So just to be clear, I believe that all of us as new Africans, we have a duty to be able to be ready at any time when it comes to being fully engaged and active in our own liberation. I believe in self-determination. I believe in self-defense. So in that, we do need to have some level of training in order to be able to defend ourselves. What that looks like is different for each person. Now, there's a concept within martial arts, and other martial artists, when they hear this, they're going to immediately be able to identify with it. Not every martial art is for everybody. You understand what I'm saying? Like, for example, somebody who's tall with long limbs, they're probably not best suited for Brazilian jiu-jitsu, because Brazilian jiu-jitsu involves you getting close and doing a lot of grappling and getting on the ground and stuff like that, whereas their strong suit may be to maintain distance. So the martial art that may better suit them might be taekwondo, you know, something that involves a lot of kicks and keeping space. That's just like kind of an example, you know, just to kind of create the comparison. But in that, I say, you know, in training for self-defense looks different for different people. The grandma can't do the same things that I can. My wife can't do the same stuff that maybe you can. But there's a level of preparedness that does need to be there as a base level so that if anything were to happen, take care of ourselves. So, you know, self-defense, first and foremost, comes in the form of understanding your environment. So the basic understanding of your environment has to be there. You have to know where your exits are, your entry points, You have to know what type of issues could come that could block your exits and entry points, so on and so forth. Excuse me. You have to have sort of an understanding of your weapon. So if your weapon is a firearm, you need to understand how to take the firearm apart and put it back together in the dark, because you never know, you might actually need to know how to do that. You need to understand what your firearm does. So the difference between a revolver and something like a Glock, like there's a different mechanical understanding. And then on the physical level, when it comes to self-defense, you know, you have to really understand your body, right? So me, where I am now, I'm 6'1". These days I'm closer to about 240, carrying a lot of muscle. So I know that my strong suit would be power, not necessarily being like, fighting somebody that's 160 pounds wouldn't necessarily be good for them if I got my hands on them. But if it was a long fight, it wouldn't be good for me. Understanding that as a martial artist, you can play to your strong suits. So those are like levels when it comes to really understanding how to protect yourself. You got to have a level of base understanding of what you can and can't do. And then you have to be able to expand that and look at the world and see, okay, I can do this, but I can't do this. How does that match up with what somebody else can and can't do? What does that match up to what my enemy can and can't do? Because the art of war is to know yourself. You got to know yourself and know your enemy. And if you don't know yourself, knowing your enemy is doesn't even matter. You see what I'm saying? So to kind of get a little bit more specific when it comes to self-defense, I think that it's important to have like a physical understanding. And that's why a lot of my work as a certified personal trainer and a martial artist instructor is to help people understand how to better utilize their body. So I work in functional fitness. So I help people be able to use their body in the way it's intended, you know, from your hip hinge to your shoulder movements, neck, legs, arms, so on and so forth, your back, all that kind of stuff. Once you understand how your body works, then you'll have a better understanding on how to execute your martial art techniques, your combat art techniques, so on and so forth. So, you know, just going from the basics of understanding your body, but also, too, and that kind of leads to a good point, understanding your body in self-defense also comes in knowing when to run, knowing when to walk away, knowing when to, you know, you in a situation and you hear somebody, you know, wilding out, la, 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 la. You probably thinking in your mind, like, I could take this guy, but the surroundings and the environment may not necessarily be conducive for the situation that would arise. Like, if I was a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu and somebody's talking crazy and they're all in my face, I could probably hem this guy up, put him in a choke, he'd be out in a few seconds, right? But while I'm tussling and rolling around the ground with this guy, somebody else who I don't even know is involved, they can come and stomp me out. And I end up dead because I'm thinking I'm going to win the fight when I could have just walked away. So a lot of that goes into self-defense as well, understanding your environment, your ability to operate within that environment. And also, too, understanding what you put in your body does to your ability to defend yourself. Like, if all you eat is junk, you won't have any energy. If you don't exercise, your body doesn't know what to do when it's time to actually work. You can watch all the videos you want. You can read all the books you want. You could even go to classes and throw punches and kicks and stuff like that. But if you have a bunch of junk in your body, your body doesn't have the fuel it needs to actually be able to do what you need it to do. You know, so all of those things go into the concepts of self-defense. And it's stuff that, you know, I work with people on. I work with people individually as well as within groups on those concepts.
Can you tell a little about your relationship with Bob Watan and Tan Yemba and the New York martial arts system?
Baba Watani, man, that's another one of my mentors, man. That's my Baba, man. Him, Baba AK, Baba Kungu Akinyele, all of them, man, they really kind of helped to form my identity. And I began training under Kupi Ghana Ngumi, under Baba Watani Tamba. He is the inventor of that system. And learning that system and being taught not only in an African-based martial art, but also using Swahili in the African class, in the African martial arts class, like that had a profound effect on me. Because I'm a lifelong martial artist. Like I've grown up, you know, learning Taekwondo, Jeet Kune Do, Muay Thai most recently, Krav Maga, and learning that Kupi Ghana Ngumi has really expanded my outlook on what a martial artist can and can't do. Because oftentimes when you learn different martial arts, you feel like, okay, I need to stick to this art. And, you know, I think Bruce Lee was probably the best example of, you know, how to create a mixed martial art. I think he was the first what we would call mixed martial artist because he took elements from different martial arts, from boxing, from Wing Chun, and all these different types of kung fu, and he put it together and made his own style, Jeet Kune Do. And I think Kupi Ghana Ngumi is another example of mixed martial arts. It goes into this whole concept of New African, right? So my understanding of New African is we are African separated from the continent of Africa. So our consciousness and our context is a little bit different than an African born in, say, Senegal or South Africa or Ethiopia, something like that. So for us, we have to actively build our context as Africans and build our consciousness as Africans. And Kupi Ghana Ngumi being a mixed martial art is sort of it's right in line with that, where we can take different elements from different martial arts to really make the martial arts system more effective. What I did was I took what I've learned from Kupi Ghana Ngumi and combined it with what I practiced in Muay Thai and in Krav Maga, and I found ways to expand it more. I haven't really had an opportunity to sit and cultivate that style with Baba Watani. So because of that, I don't call what I do Kupi Ghana Ngumi. However, you know, I'd love to be able to connect back with Baba and really build what I've done with what he's done to see if there's some synergy and find a way to actually make that the case. Because I'm the type of person, I don't necessarily think you always got to reinvent the wheel. And I think sometimes our community gets caught in that. Like we'll have something going and there's something going on within that particular group or organization that we don't like, so we'll break off and do our own thing. And you got a whole bunch of different people breaking off and doing their own thing, and you got groups of thousands as opposed to one big group of a million. You see what I'm saying? So for me, I'd love to be able to find a way to take what I do, take what I'm working on now, and combine it with what's already been established in Kupi Ghana Ngumi, as well as with, like, brothers who do Balagoon and all that kind of stuff, like connecting with all these different African martial arts factions and being able to have, an African martial arts family. You see what I'm saying? Where we're able to sort of feed off of each other, develop each other's arts. We can spar together and really find ways to solidify and strengthen our new African self-defense systems.
Yes, sir. You know, I'm trying to back what you're saying in regards to it. My next question is, tell me how important is it for the sisters and the youth to be trained as well? How important is it? How significant it is?
Oh, it's super important, man. It's super important because if you don't train the youth and you don't train the sisters, then whenever there is, say, for example, and this is kind of an extreme example, but let's say there is, like, a draft. Let's just, you know, create a scenario where our new African nation has created a draft, and we got to go to war. Like, we got to get out here, and there's an active enemy that we got to step up against, right? Who's going to protect our homes? I mean, I'm assuming that every man may not necessarily be on the front line, that might not necessarily be their position, their role. But at home, you know, our wives have to be able to protect the home. Our children have to be able to at least protect themselves. I mean, we got in Atlanta alone, like Atlanta is the hub for, you know, human trafficking. And I believe that if we're able to at least get somebody off you so you don't end up at the second location, that'll allow you to be able to thwart some of the attacks on our community where people are trying to take our bodies and put them on sale. You understand what I'm saying? So it's super important. But also, too, if you think about it, the mother is the first teacher of the children. So if our women have the opportunity to learn self-defense and to learn these different combat arts, you know, not just for the ability to fight, but to cultivate themselves, cultivate their body, cultivate discipline and things of that sort, then they're able to effectively teach that to our children. And it's not like a fad. It's more of a culture that our children grow up in, and they're able to actively adapt in it. And it sort of goes without saying, as opposed to it being sort of like a, you know, a fleeting thing where they're trying this and they're trying that. You know, I've taught martial arts, you know, in different contexts. And I remember in particular, you know, teaching with a mixed martial arts faction. I won't say their name because they're not New African. But I taught with them, and I encountered a lot of parents who said that they want their children to try this and see, you know, if they like it and try that. And I could tell that the parent didn't have a clue that that's not the way to go about it because they themselves weren't disciplined. And as a result, you know, the kids kind of half doing it. They kind of, you know, I don't feel good today, so I don't want to go to train, things of that sort. Like, when you're training, the training is regardless. Like, if I don't feel good today, if I'm – like this morning, I didn't get that much sleep. But I still had to get up. I still had to train because I knew that if I could do that, I'm going to keep my body, you know, in the motion, in the right momentum for improvement. Because if you're not moving forward, you're moving back. So we gotta create that context within our family unit so that the mothers can impart in our children the importance of protecting yourself and being fully aware of your environment at all times.
Yes, sir. You know, the reason I asked that because, you know, a lot of times, you know, it is stereotypical situation in regards to that new African women are weak, that they're not strong, they're not weak, and as if the new African women doesn't have a history of being warriors. You know, they doesn't have a history of being strong and combative all around, you know what I'm saying, from the antiquity to now, right? You know, and it even has certain deities and rituals and African powers that are associated with different forms of combat, different forms of strength, right? You know, people get their wrong misconception about certain things, right? You know what I'm saying? If we didn't come from a warrior culture in general, you know, and we still fighting this war present since 1619 from our new African historical order, we still fighting this war, you know. It's not just new African men, it's new African women and children as well that's fighting this war along with us also, right? So it's always good hear that, the type of information.
Yeah, ahead, man, the women have to be in power, bro. I didn't mean to interrupt you, I apologize. The women have to be in power, bro. They have to have, like, history shows that, you know, if you have a nation where you have strong women, you have a strong nation. You see what I'm saying? Like, you can't just have a bunch of strong men and then the women sitting around all meek and nothing wrong with meekness in general, but they don't have the ability to stand up against some type of oppression. Like, and even if you take it out of the New African context and you put it in just the world history context, the majority of the nation states that lasted for a long time had strong women. You see what I'm saying? So if you keep it in the New African context, if we think about, like, for example, the conflicts in Africa where the European nations were colonizing Africa, which country was the country that was never colonized? Ethiopia. Ethiopia wasn't colonized because they had strong women. And they even think some of the you know, when you think about like East Africa, a lot of times we sleep on East Africa, but the East African culture is founded on the concept of a strong woman. Even if you go all the way back to the concept of Asar and Aset, right? When in the Asarian drama, when Asar was cut up into those 14 pieces and thrown into the Nile River, you know, Aset, she went out to find those pieces. She was able to find all the pieces except for one, which is the phallus, and then she was able to gain the wisdom and the magical power from Tahuti to be able to recreate that phallus into something magical and to give birth to what we call Heru. You see what I'm saying? All of that being said, you got to be a strong woman to go through that. You can't be no weak woman to see your husband get cut up and you just sitting around crying and let it go. No, she got up and she did something about it. And this is
no doubt.
This is cosmology that goes back 10,000 years. You see what I'm saying? So it's in our DNA when it comes to strong women. And it's just in a current context of strong women. If you need an example, you can just look at my wife, man. You know, she's a strong woman. You know, and she's from New Africa. She's from Alabama, so she come up around a bunch of folks out there, and all the women out there are strong. So if you ask any of them, they're gonna look at you crazy if you say New African women ain't strong. You see what I'm saying? So yeah, let's just make sure that's clear. And, you know, I always think it's odd, right? And this is kind of a side note. I always think it's odd whenever men take the time and the energy to criticize the strength of women or to talk about women, and it goes either way. It could either be, oh, women ain't strong, they need to sit down somewhere, or they say something like women too strong, they too masculine. And one of the things that I had to come to the realization going through my wellness warrior journey was that us men, we set the tone for women. So if in our culture we're experiencing, we're experiencing sort of an alien energy from our women, energy that we're not necessarily comfortable with, something that may come across as too masculine, then that means that we're lacking in our masculinity because they feel like they need to be more masculine in order to compensate. You know, it's like this planet is based off of, you know, trying to reach equilibrium. So if you have a community where the men are too weak, then the women will compensate and become stronger. You see what I'm saying? And what we have today is like a black society in America specifically where we've given our men permission to be punks. We've given our men permission to be weak. And then as these weak beta men, we are now saying, well, our women are they need to come up and they need to come to us and they need to really just bow down and, you know, become more submissive and da da da. But it's like you don't even have the energy or the context of manhood to present them something to submit to. You see what I'm saying? So a lot of that, when it comes to criticisms of women, really falls back on us. If me as a man, the women that I'm interacting with, if they're coming across too masculine, then there's probably something that I'm putting out in terms of energy that's allowing them that ability to do that. You know, more often than not, when I interact with women, even if they're, you know, women who choose to be LGBT or whatever, more often than not, I could pull the femininity out of them, not because I'm just some Don Juan dude, but because my energy is that of a masculine man who is cultivating his masculine energy in the right directions. I'm not trying to be overbearing and toxic. I'm not trying to, you know, defile the woman or put her down or make her less than. I'm trying to build up the women, build up the woman so that I can be a better man, because I can't be who I am without that woman being who she is. You see what I'm saying? I know that was kind of off the beaten path a little bit, but I felt like that needed to be said.
Right. It wasn't off the path, brother. You know, it's all about articulating, you know what I'm saying, yourself, man, and expressing your own self-style wisdom, however you see it fit and what it's about, man. It's a platform to educate and enlighten people. So how you present yourself is how you present yourself, and it's on the listeners to take heed to it, to digest it, to whatever it's you to do with the information you put out there, you know. That's what we're doing. We inform the people, man. You know, my next question is, no doubt, my next question is, you say you've been a youth advocate since 2005, right? Now I want to ask you in regards to the martial arts and the hip hop. How do you coincide or combine those two in order to reach the youth?
Man, you know what? I'm about to hit you with some old school, man. I'm about to hit you with some old school. You remember Last Dragon?
Yes, sir. Bruce Leroy.
Bruce Leroy, man. So I remember, like, if you think about, like, the context of that movie is in the same context as movies like Breaking and Crush Groove and things of that sort. Because what it shows is early hip-hop culture sort of forming itself. And us as New Africans, we've always taken elements of different things and made it our own. Bruce Leroy was, like, a martial artist. And he was a martial artist in the context of martial arts. It was cool, but kind of not really cool. You see what I'm saying? His little brother was, you know, in the hip-hop. He was a breakdancer dude, and he was kicking around rappers and stuff like that. So for me, like, it all really bleeds together. I think when it comes to, you know, the original roots of hip-hop and, you know, I'm connected with Zulu Nation as well, so I'm able to build with some of those guys. Like building with Zulu Nation, like what I've seen is hip hop is a culture that is forever developing. So I can see how, like, martial arts, in particular New African combat arts, can really be something that can be embraced within hip hop culture. Nowadays, when it comes to hip-hop is more expansive in terms of the view of what hip-hop is, because now anybody can do it. It used to be where you had to have, like, the hottest record, you had to have a record label behind you, you had to be the dopest rapper in the hood in order for anybody to hear you. Now we got the internet, and any Joe Blow with a microphone and studio time can record some music. So what that allows is for different personalities and different cultures and different contexts to be put out there for people to absorb and have you know, take part in. So for me, you know, I'm all about authenticity, and I'm gonna be honest. Like, you know, I've been involved with the streets and all that kind of stuff, but that ain't really no context I like to really celebrate like that for real, because I'm not big on rapping about killing my brother. You know, I'm gonna shoot this nigga, I'm gonna take your chick, da 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 da. You know. I'm laughing because I was thinking about a quote from Kanye. I'll get to that in a second, but you know, it's wild when you think about the opportunities and the ability to really be able to spit game on the level of, you know, combat arts and hip hop. Like it's tied together because, you know, there's this whole idea of you know, freestyling. So say, for example, like, if I'm freestyling, you know, in terms of the rap spitting off the top of the dome, it's easy for me to kind of pick up stuff that's in the area based on, you know, where I'm at and put that in my rap. Same thing with martial arts. If I'm in a fight and it's a street fight, I'm a freestyle. I'm not going to stand there and do a jab, cross, hook, round kick, you know, roundhouse, jump kick. I'm not going to do no set combination. I'm a freestyle because you know, in the context of what's going on, I'm going to use what's in my environment to create the context on how I'm going to whoop this dude's ass. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah,
that's kind of how that goes in terms of, right, you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, you know, the whole concept of guerrilla warfare is just, you know, a smaller army utilizing what they have available to take down a larger army. You see what I'm saying? And whenever you take down a cadre of that larger army, you take their weapons, you take some of their supplies, and you make yourself stronger. You make yourself bigger. And that's the same thing when it comes to hip-hop. You can take from different contexts. You know, that's why you got, you know, for a time, you know, hip-hop was embracing jazz. For a time, hip-hop was embracing hip-hop, embracing rock and roll, rather. So you had, like, rock and roll elements in the hip-hop, you know, and you got more of the reggaeton, Latin influences in hip-hop. You got all kind of different things that can influence hip-hop. So the same thing goes for martial arts. I think that it all can sort of, you know, coincide and live together. And plus two, I think that if you present combat arts in a way that the hip hop community can embrace it, it'll make it easier for folks in hip hop to really want to learn martial arts and stay healthy using it. Because I don't know about you, but I remember like kind of guys making fun of dudes in martial arts when I was in the school. You in a karate class and your ass can't fight, da 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 da, that kind of stuff. And they're making fun of guys in martial arts because the perception is you doing karate, that's lame. But like nowadays, mixed martial arts is a whole lot more popular than martial arts used to be. So I can see it being a little bit easier for young people to embrace.
You know, historically, man, when New Africans were first exposed to the martial arts during the 60s and 70s, you know, like it was something that a lot of them were banned for doing that. They were banned for doing that by the state, the government, and other aspects, right? So by being in that manner, you know, it received negative connotation in regard to what it is and why you're doing it, and people want to associate certain things with like the spirituality aspect of people doing meditation and yoga and the different scratches and all that. It looked at that being soft, you know. So that genre came about in regard to that situation. It's a soft genre, you know, then to speak in a lot of people's mind, that due to the West High Society had paid it in regards to New African. But as soon as the European do it, or the Asian, somebody else do it, you know what I'm saying, it wasn't looked at that way, like, oh, he know karate. Oh, he know kung fu. You know? He'll beat you up, you know. But when we do it, you know, he look at, he'll sissy, he'll punk, you know, he this and that, you know.
Man, let me tell you something, man. Since I have been like a personal trainer and a martial artist the past few years, I have met more white people who are actively practicing martial arts than I've ever met in my life. I meet all kinds of people who are in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, BJJ, you know, so they know how to grapple. They're doing judo. I used to teach kickboxing, and I remember teaching kickboxing. I remember having classes because I was teaching, you know, with an organization that wasn't New African. I remember having classes that were majority white women. They in there and they doing all these different combos and doing all these different moves, and they got the wind, so they really can like probably go if they you know was focused on training. Like this is kickboxing class is more of a an exercise class than it is actually, you know, a self-defense context, but I do have self-defense context in it in order to make it interesting. And these folks in there is really getting at it. And I'm seeing all these white folks walking around here knowing all these different martial arts, and I'm thinking to myself, it ain't like it used to be. You remember when, you know, a black man walk up the street and you see a white dude, you kind of just jump at him, they get scared. Like, nowadays, If you try that, you might run up on the wrong white dude. He'll grab you up and put you in like a BJJ move and have you tap out on the street or something like that. And that's another reason why I think it's important for us to really step up on a self-defense piece, because it ain't like it used to be, man. Times are changing, man. You know, the world is moving forward. Like these these white people
and these folks
who got money to pay for it, they get out here and they get trained, they shooting guns, they at the range, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we got to get on point. We got to get on code. And not saying that we're not doing this, because we definitely are doing it in different factions here or there, but it has to become more of a cultural thing. Like, it has to be more of us just as a whole embracing it, and not just a few folks here and there, because that's when it kind of gets scary. Like, I've been in a group with black dudes, you know, my cousin and some of his guys, and we're out and we're kicking it, and like something to happen, and I'm thinking to myself, man, can't none of these dudes fight. My cousin is big, so he can hold his own. You know what I mean? He can fight. He's from the Shy. All the rest of these dudes that's with us, man, they a liability. They are a liability. And if something happens, I might have to pull my tool just to be safe, because I don't think these guys can fight. And like, knowing that really makes me really like push more to engage and tell people, like, listen, man, we got to get on this combat arts. If the word martial art, if the phrase martial art is a little too played out for you, let's call it a combat art. Let's call it a combat science. Whatever we got to do,
yeah,
we got to
martial science. Yeah.
How to fight.
No doubt. You know, I got a question, right? Have you seen that movie, Woman King?
I haven't. I think I know where you're going with the question, but I'll let you ask it.
Okay. Well, I want to say, if you have seen it, I want to know what your perspective is from a martial art, from a fighter perspective, in regards to like, in regards to a fighter perspective, from the movie perspective. Do you actually feel that the action was effeminating the men, that the women are stronger than the men? But you say you haven't seen it, though. That's why I want to ask that perspective, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of different perspectives going around in regards to the movie. People don't have seen it, you know. But people are not coming from different – people come from different ideological backgrounds, though, in regards to it. You know, so I myself, I don't seen it. And my thoughts is that it wasn't no effemination of no men or none of that, right? You know, the men mm-hmm. were fighting along with the women. You know what I'm saying? They all were fighting, you know, in regards
right.
to everything. It was a lot of new African, but they were fighting still nonetheless, though, right? It wasn't that answer mm-hmm. to my effeminization or the women were too masculine. It wasn't none of that, you know.
Yeah.
Not my opinion.
You know,
I saw it.
I appreciate you bringing up that point, man. So my reason for not seeing Woman King isn't because I was concerned that they were going to have women being too masculine or effeminate, having the men being too effeminate or whatever. Like, that wasn't my concern, because I understand Hollywood. So if that would have happened, you know, it would have been whatever. But I was pretty sure that they wouldn't have took that route. My problem with the movie was, as a historian, I just couldn't get with it. You see what I'm saying?
Oh,
like,
you already know. You already know.
You
it's
know,
just a bunch of BS in the history, man. You know, they do it all the time. You know that.
Yeah, and I understand that. So I take an active stance where I don't watch slave movies.
It takes away from the substance when you do that, though. It takes a lot away from the substance, you know.
Yeah, because I can't even focus on the movie. I wouldn't have been able to focus on Woman King watching it, knowing that the historical context is wrong. Like, I remember watching Birth of a Nation. I only watched that because I was interested in seeing how they did Nat Turner, because Nat Turner is one of my favorite ancestors. But
it made that look bad.
Yeah, like I was like, man, they just kind of you know, trashed our history, man. And I'm just not a big fan of that. Like, I'm not a big fan of them characterizing, because essentially, when you really think about the tribe of women that the woman king was about, the Home, the Home were slave like capturers. Like they were out there getting slaves, enslaving Africans and selling them to Europeans. Let's just call it what it is. I love the fact that we have strong women represented in black media, even though it's not necessarily our media, but it's, you know, a movie full of black people. I love how, because Viola Davis is one of my favorite actresses, but, you know, the Dahomey, like, I look at the Dahomey the same way I look at, and it's kind of harsh, but it just is what it is. I look at the Dahomey the same way I look at black people who sell other black folks crack. You know what I'm saying? Like, because they could have took a whole different route historically, and they decided to cash in on the slave trade, probably because they didn't know exactly what was going on in the U.S. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I mean, I can't say. Probably because at the time it was more economically feasible for them, so it made sense for them to take that route historically. But, like, I look at that, and it really makes me question who, like, us as a people and how we like to just go for anything just because it's black. Like, that's kind of a scary concept, because if you start just going for anything just because it's black, that's when you get into a lot of bull. You see what I'm saying? Like, we got Obama because he was black. But what did Obama do for us? You know, we got Herschel Walker in the state of Georgia running for president, and we got black folks voting for him because he's black. Herschel Walker came home and put a fence together. You see what I'm saying?
And like, yeah, you run up for Senate. You run up for Senate.
Yeah, and you know, there's plenty of other contexts of black folks who, just because they black, they getting pushed into the forefront, and they ain't good for shit. You know what I mean? And matter of fact, while I'm even talking about that,
Honorable Mark Garvey said, he said a lot of people who ain't good here are not gonna be good when we go back to Africa. You know, he said
right. Like, and the best example of that historically is Liberia. You know what I'm saying? Like, they took black people who were formerly enslaved in what we call America, sent them back to Africa with a bunch of Eurocentric context, and that turned Liberia into a powder keg. To this day, they still having civil wars because you got the blacks who came from the American slave trade, and he got the blacks who were already there, and they're still fighting. They're still having problems because, you know, they didn't take the time to actually understand the Africans they were engaging with. They just came over there like, we just gonna do a black version of America over here, and it didn't work. You know what I'm saying? And far too often, we just go for it because it's black. We have to actually, you know, look at, okay, it's black. But I have to have the same level of, you know, having a high expectation for it as I would anything else. You see what I'm saying? Like, when you walk into a black restaurant and people are giving you bad service, but you still eat there because they black, like, you ain't doing yourself no good. You ain't doing them no good because they think they can get over with that type of attitude. We got to hold it to a higher standard. We got to say, hey, bro, I want to shop with you. I love buying black. Your service is crap. Your food ain't all that. Got to step it up. But we feel like we're not really black. We not really nationalists. We not really, you know, soul brothers. If we take that perspective, we got to start taking that perspective, bro. We got to. Cause we got to raise the standard on what it means to be New African. Raise the standard on what it means to be black so that when we say young, gifted, and black, it really means something. It ain't just a phrase that we just keep repeating over generations.
True indeed. At this time, you know, I want to thank you for coming on to our broadcast. At this time, I want to let the listeners get a chance to have a conversation and ask questions, make statements. All right. So at this time, if you have any questions, statements, or comments, or announcement, please press 1 so I can open your line. At this time, please press 1 if you have any questions or you want to get into a problem dialogue. Please press 1 at this time. brother. I appreciate everything you're saying, though. You know, appreciate the work you're doing, man.
Man,
I appreciate
having the ability to do it, you know.
No doubt, man. I actually got one more question, right? You said what it means to be a new African. What does it mean to be a new African? You know, from your perspective, what does it mean to be a new African from your perspective? A conscious new African today. What does it mean to you?
Man, I appreciate that question, bro. So for me, new African means that we have the ability to determine our own destiny in this American context where we currently live today. So in my personal background, of course, you know, it's easy to tell that my family does have descendants that come from the continent of Africa, in particular, the Upper Guinea region of Africa. So sort of like Northwest Africa, mid-Northwest Africa region, Guinea-Bissau, so on and so forth. I also have ancestors that come from so-called North America, you know, Native American, so-called Native American ancestry. So that ties me directly to this land. And the new African context for me allows me to be able to fully embrace that context without having to have like a dual consciousness. You see what I'm saying? Because us as Africans, we populated the earth, and the so-called Native American, like, they are the ones who set the stage for the reason why Europeans came over here. And even before Europeans came over to this continent, Africans were coming back and forth to North America. So, you know, having that connection to the land for me is invaluable because it allows me to be able to have no shame in embracing my Africanness. Embracing African language. You know, my family were learning Swahili so that we could speak Swahili within our household. You know, being able to have that level of connection and being able to have the blood connection to this land, to New Africa, what we call New Africa, you know, those five states, you know, yes, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, that's our land. And it's not just our land because we say so. It's our land because we say so and we mean it. Our blood is here. Our blood is tied to this land. You see what I'm saying? My ancestry is tied to this land. So it allows me to be able to have a different context than the so-called Native American context. Are you familiar with the Dawes Rolls?
Familiar with what?
Something called the Dawes Rolls. They talked about it a little bit in Hidden Colors. The Dawes Rolls is... So the same time that they were giving black people, the Emancipation Proclamation, and there were some federal programs designed help the transition black people into being free, they also have programs designed to help transition Native Americans. There were programs designed to transition Native Americans into having control over lands that they later called reservations. However, there was a something called the Dawes Rolls where they would literally take account of who was actually a Native American. They did this because they didn't want Africans who, you know, actually may have been Native American, you know, we're black in this land. They didn't want the black people to actually be on the Dawes Rolls. So they wanted to create a distinction between lighter, fair-skinned Native Americans and darker-skinned Negroes, as they call them, which a lot of these folks were actually Native Americans because the real Native Americans, exactly, you know what I'm saying, the Seminoles, the Chickasaws, the Blackfoot, I can go on and on, Cherokee, these were black people. These were black-skinned people, you know. But they were kept off the Dawes Rolls to make room for the lighter complected Native Americans to actually be considered Native American, thereby getting reservation land. And then, you know, white people, they had to get their piece, so they pay some money so they could get on the Dawes Rolls. And that's why you see these white people walking around calling themselves Native Americans with arrow tattoos on them and all that kind of goofy shit. They're what we call $5 Indians. They paid $5 to be put on the doll's robes.
Yes, sir. But, yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know. I got a caller. Right, open their line up right quick. Appreciate information on their line up right quick. 901-480. Your line is open. You got any question, comment, statement? 901-480. Your line is open. Go ahead.
Free to land. How y'all doing tonight? This is Sister Melly Queen. How y'all doing tonight?
I'm well, sister.
How you doing, Brother Tyree? I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. You know, you've been on my show before. How you doing today?
I'm blessed. I'm blessed. And you can say Tairu. It's easy on the American song. It's pronounced Tairu with a heavy T, but you can say Tairu. It's all good.
All right. Thank you. I wanted to ask your perspective on New African Revolutionary Nationalism, right? I'm taking PE classes now, and I'm learning, you know, more about that, you know, we need this global unity in order to win this war. What are your thoughts on that?
Just so I'm clearing your question, you said my thoughts
on New African Revolutionary Nationalism. Yes.
Okay. So, From a historical perspective, New African Revolutionary Nationalism is broad. And the reason I say that is because New African Revolutionary Nationalism can be considered revolutionary nationalism from organizations like CORE, SNCC, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, so on and so forth. We could look at it that way. We could look at it in the concept of the provisional government in New Africa. And kind of look at it from that perspective, or we can look at it in a more theoretical perspective. But just to get to the heart of your question, I think that revolutionary consciousness is a consciousness that involves having to really commit to the end goal. So you have to ask yourself, revolution to what end? You see what I'm saying? And if you don't have an end to your revolution, if you don't have, this is what I want to gain from this movement, I'm a revolutionary nationalist because I want A, B, and C to happen. If you don't have that clearly defined, then you're just burning gas and you're going to burn out. You know, I've been involved in New African Revolutionary Consciousness since 2005. I initially got involved in it during the time of Hurricane Katrina. A group of us actually went out to different parts of the areas that were affected by Hurricane Katrina in southern Mississippi and Louisiana in order to help with, like, the cleanup efforts and stuff like that. And that's when I really learned about different concepts of New African Revolutionary Nationalists, and not just here in Georgia, but also in Mississippi and in Louisiana, how they all looked at it. One of the things that I saw that was consistent, not only is the fresh fire that comes from the revolutionary nationalism that I learned, but also there's a trail of bones of people who were burnt out from working in revolutionary nationalist concepts because they didn't know the end goal. You see what I'm saying? Like they would fully envelop themselves in the work. They would fully tie themselves to their identity. And maybe they might neglect some things here and there within their household or personally. And as a result, what would happen is when they look up and they have like a crisis, which we all have issues. We all have a crisis. We all have things we have to deal with in life because that's what life is. When those things happen and they didn't get the proper response from or the response that they thought they should have got from the people that they were connected with, whether it was the organization or the group of friends or whoever it may have been, they began to become disheartened in the movement because a revolutionary movement, by definition, is a protracted movement. So you have to expect that your movement is going to take a while to actually materialize. And what happens when you have a personal crisis and there's no one there to help you through that personal crisis, your focus goes from I'm going to do this as long as it takes to I can't do this anymore. I need to focus on me. And it becomes, hey, I can't even do it anymore, period. I can't even look at that stuff. And I've seen people who, when I first got involved in it, who are revolutionary nationalists in the New African context, you know, they had locks and they were natural and all this and all that kind of stuff. Man, they messed around and had something go on, cut their locks off, got a perm, married a white dude, moved on with their life in the suburbs somewhere. I say all that to say, sister, it's important for you to take as much opportunity as you can to connect with elders and to read as much material as you can in order for you to really get a full understanding for yourself of what New African revolutionary consciousness means to you and what your personal end goal is. And once you get that end goal, like, set in your heart and a full understanding within your mind, allow that to lead every decision you make from that point on, so that you'll know that some of your decisions may sort of conflict with some of your peers who may see themselves as revolutionary nationalists because they don't have the same concepts of necessity as you do. Don't let that waver you. Just know that we're all human and we're going to have some points where we agree and some points where we disagree, but make sure that it's for you and what you have defined within your heart as New African revolutionary consciousness is for you and not what somebody else gave you.
I say, thank you. Thank you. And like I said, thank you for this valuable show tonight. Y'all have had an awesome show. And I free the land.
Father, me miss it.
Thank you, sister. Free the land. Salute.
Okay. Okay. You have anything else, Sister Miller Queen, or that was it?
That was it. That was it. Like I said, I've gotten a lot of information, took a lot of notes, and I appreciate it. I appreciate you all, and thank y'all for the work y'all doing.
Man, I appreciate so
thank
all
you.
The work you're doing.
Thank
sir.
You for your work.
No doubt. No doubt.
I would say.
Okay. I don't see nobody else in the queue, right? So if anybody have a question, a comment, a statement, an announcement, they can press one. You know what I'm saying? I hope you're lined up. If not, this is what I wanted to ask, right? In regard to the youth, right, and working with them, in regard to working with youth, tell me some of the most successful ways and methods to reach them from your own perspective and your experiences, right?
Man, that's a wonderful question, man. Thank you for that. I have so many awesome experiences when it comes to working with youth, man. One of my favorite memories when it comes to working with youth, and I've got a lot of them. So I'm gonna give you a couple of examples, but this one in particular is one of my favorite. So I remember when I first started really teaching Kupigana and Ngumi, through Baba Watani, because I was training with them pretty regularly at that point. And I asked for permission to be able to, you know, teach, because I had some people who had invited me out to teach some martial arts within their school. So there was this one school I used to go to teach, and I think I was there like twice a week. So I would come, and it was I think it may have been 15 to 20 students. There's a lot of students in that class, a lot of students. But there were two students in particular that I felt like really needed what I was given the most. One of those students was this young boy. I want to say these were like fifth graders who were in the class, maybe a couple fourth graders. This dude, he was so quiet, so to himself, real awkward, real shy. He spoke really low. When he talked to you, he kept his head down, all this kind of stuff. And I remember throughout the semester seeing his growth. And this is just a semester. Like I didn't have a super long amount of time with these students, but it was just a semester. And I remember seeing his growth and his ability to communicate, his ability to have confidence in himself and to really, like, he was feeling himself. And by the end of that, by the end of the semester, this dude's his martial art technique was crisp. He was strong. He was doing push-ups where he wasn't doing, like, he probably do one or two push-ups at the beginning of the semester. Now he's doing like 20, knocking them out, bang, back to back, 20 at a time, bow, 20 more, bow. And I remember his mom coming to me in tears, telling me that how much she appreciated what I've done for her son. She said she's never seen him as talkative as he was ever taking my class. She's never seen him as involved. It's like a whole new kid has awakened in him. And I remember her telling me that in tears, because I could only imagine what type of life he had been dealing with prior to that that had him, you know, in that sort of shell mode. You see what I'm saying? So that I'm honestly proud of that moment to be able to change his life and all the other students I dealt with lives as well. That was very important to me. Another context I could think of is as a teacher, this in the school setting, you know, teaching history. I can remember, you know, teachers don't get enough credit, man. Teachers don't get enough credit for their influence on children, because not only are we teaching, like, classroom lessons for them to be able to graduate high school, but we are their counselors, we are their uncles, we are their trusted ears when they don't trust anybody else to listen to them. I've had students, you know, in my class who, you know, they were afraid to tell their parents that they wanted to practice witchcraft. They were afraid to tell their parents that they wanted to practice African spirituality because their parents were Christian. They were afraid to, you know, tell their parents that, you know, it's so many different things that I was able to sort of build relationships with young people and help them to value themselves more, man. Like, you know, as a teacher, like, that's one of the most impactful positions that you have. I find I've had so many different instances of that, I can't even count.
I appreciate that. I got another call up in the opening line right now.
Okay.
312-885. You got any questions, comments, statements, please do so at any time. 312-885. Your line is open. Go ahead.
Hey, Free the Land. Welcome to the show, good brother. Y'all sound great.
Damn, bro.
Free the Land, brother. Salute.
I was just calling. I wanted to know if you were going to be doing any demonstrations, maybe of your art at Nation Day or something. Do you have a dojo in the area? I missed the beginning, so I didn't hear, you know, how are you teaching your art, martial arts.
Okay. Yeah, so in terms of, well, I'm located in Georgia right now. I'm down in Atlanta, Georgia. So honestly, man, anytime that there is like an event or something going on, I would love to be a part of it. So it's just a matter of me being plugged in to be there. My wife and I just had our son, so this past year I was a little out of pocket because we were kind of getting ready for this bundle of joy here. But now that he's born,
yeah,
I can move around a little bit more, you know. So I definitely am looking forward. Yeah, he's probably him in the background. I mean, he's been talking all so long. But yeah, man.
I love
the interview too.
Yeah, he's been even coaching me, man. He's like, "No, Baba, tell him this, tell him that." But yeah, man. Anything that's coming up, you know, in 2023, you know, I'd love to be a part of it, to do demonstrations and you know, provide some information sessions and even set up some group classes. I don't currently have my own dojo. That's something that my wife and I have talked about, you know, working on. So within a very short time, we should have that. There's some other priorities we're kind of working on first, but that is something that's definitely in the works. And it may be sooner than later because you never know how the Most High works, man. It's like, you know, when you prepare for something, you never know, you know, how the Creator works in your life. It may just happen without you even, you know, being necessarily ready mentally, but you might be ready in the spirit and it just comes. So I say all that to say I don't currently have a dojo yet, but it is something that we're working on. But I am available to do group sessions. What I'll probably end up doing in the next year is just staying plugged into, you know, a lot of different community events around the country so that I can go and kind of be a part of it, you know, my family and I, so that we can really plug in and find some communities for us to work with. I think organically what will end up happening from that is we'll eventually build a dojo. If you've ever seen like Ip Man or any of those kung fu movies, a lot of times what happens is the more people see the master, the more people want to work with the master. And I've been kind of in the shadows, man. Self-appointed, of course, because like I said, you know, family's been first. But at this point, I definitely want to, you know, gain some more access to people. So you will be seeing a lot more of me really soon. If you can follow me on Instagram, Zaluted Obuya, this Zaluted with a Z. If you follow me there, then you at least be in touch with me. That way, when more stuff is out there, you'll see me posted on IG. And if you want to just kind of shoot me like a DM and kind of connect with me that way, we can maybe arrange some things where you are locally for me to come out there and chop it up with your folks.
Okay. Give me that Zaluted, like salute.
Yeah. So it's spelled the same way, just with a Z. And then underscore O-B-U-Y-A, Obuya. So Zaluted Obuya.
O-B.
It should, if you see the flyer for today's show, it should be on there. You know, I'll definitely O-B-U-Y-A, yes, sir.
Okay,
and,
I got you.
And I will definitely keep everybody in tune on future developments for, you know, our school, because that is in the works. It's just I had to have my fun first.
Well, first things first, brother. also, I wanted to let you know, I don't know if you ever done any writing or anything. We have a newspaper called Rebuild, and we'd love it if you wouldn't mind. If you want to submit an article, we might consider it for publication, you know, about your, especially about some of your comments you made around the need for us to develop a martial culture as a people, you know, and really have the whole
people. I would love to.
All right. Well,
I would love to, brother. I'm a writer, man. I'm actually working on a book now. I didn't really say nothing about it because it's not done, but I am an avid writer, so something like that. I would love to, man. Just shoot me the information and let's go from there, bro.
Okay. All right. I'll try to figure out some way to hit you up. All right.
Shoot me a DM.
Hey, man,
what do you say, Baba Hondo?
I said that you know how to, you have his information, right?
Yeah. I can get it to you, brother.
Just tell him the website address.
Okay.
He can check out all the previous issues of the paper, and he'll know where to send any submissions.
Okay.
It's on the website. It's rebuildcollective.com. Is it? Wait a minute. Oh, shit. Rebuildcollective.org.
Yeah. I'm going to lace him up.
Yeah, and it would,
for sure.
Be good if he could do a demonstration at Nation Day. That's exactly the kind of stuff we need to be trying to develop. I'm talking to our people, too, and the sensibilities about the current situation are really pathetic. People don't seem to be this fool in Buffalo just openly admitted in court that he wanted to kill black people because he wanted to start a race war. He killed 10 people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
We definitely got to stand for stuff like that.
Yeah. So I appreciate you, man, and good to make your acquaintance. I'll be hoping that we can work together more in the future.
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure meeting you as well. I look forward to connecting with you, man. Definitely give me that info, and I'll get with Brother Bomani so that we can build on that, because I'm excited about writing. So that's right up my alley. Oh.
Cool. All right. I'm out. Thank you, brother.
All right.
Yes, sir. Green Lantern. Salute.
Anybody got any question, comment, or statement, please press 1 at this time. Please press 1. Go ahead and tell a little bit about this book you're talking about. Tell a little bit about this book.
So I'm working on a book loosely titled Manhood Manual. So growing up in life, I learned a lot of manhood lessons by trial and error. Some stuff I learned from elders, you know, uncles, and some of the babas I connected with, you know, later on in life. I've gone through rites of passage. I've gone through all types of stuff, you know, in formulating who I am as a man. And honestly, I can say I'm still super flawed. I still have plenty of room for growth, and I still have plenty of room for, you know, just becoming better at being a man. All that said, I think that it's important to at least be able to share some life lessons for young men so that they can avoid some of the trial by error lessons that I learned, and actually learn it from somebody else through, you know, the stories that I have and the different pieces of information that I'm able to provide. So the Manhood Manual is a book that's designed to be sort of a, for lack of better words, an instruction manual for forming manhood. Now, I won't say that it's the book. I won't say that it's the answer, because clearly there's different contexts when it comes to manhood, and there's different, you know, there's different definitions of manhood when it comes to us as black men, and different ways of seeing it. But it's a book. It's a attempt of me to help, you know, in our process of nation building, because nation building, it's going to be more than just us having the land. We got to know how to work on the land. And as men, we got to understand our role in that. So the Manhood Manual is just my attempt to leave something, you know, not only for my son, but for all of our sons to be able to look at as a reference to at least have some guiding principles for.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Yes, sir. No doubt. You know, it's all about nation building, man. We got to kind of close the show, right? Can you give us your final thoughts? Give us your final thoughts before we close the show.
Well, so what I'll say, man, as final thoughts is, Brother Malik Kalam had a big influence on me in terms of my role in New Africa. And he allowed me to really be able to share my gifts and to honor him in his life. His spirit literally came to me and pushed me to reignite Outlaw Radio. So one of the things that I wanted to do was bring Outlaw Radio back, but it's going to be a little bit different. Like, I can't do it the way he did it, so I'm going to do it the way I'm doing it. And what I'm doing is I want to create sort of a an outlet in order for us to be able to connect the New African consciousness on the academic level with the streets and with the rank and file Negro, for lack of better words. So I say that to say, man, in my life, all I want to do is to be able to provide a positive influence on black men in America to be better every day. Every day we wake up, we should look to be better. You know, if we're doing 20 push-ups, the next day let's do 21. If we're doing 50, let's do 51. We should always be growing. We should always be developing. And we should always take accountability for the things that happen to us in our life, both good and bad. My wife and I talk often about, you know, some of the things that we have disagreements in. But one of the things we agree about is that as a man, it's incumbent upon me to take full accountability on the direction that our marriage goes. So I encourage every man to take accountability, to take some time out and look at all the things that has happened in our lives, you know, all the things that we can rightly say that somebody else caused, somebody else wronged us, somebody else put us in position to blah, blah, blah. I want us to all take a second and think about what our role was in that. And it could have been something as small as just not paying attention. It could have been as big as it's our fault. Either way, taking some accountability for that and strengthening ourselves as a man so that we can be better next time. Next time the opportunity comes for us to do something, you know, we can do it in the right way and not have to always fall on our face. And, you know, my ministry is for all of us in New Africa, but in particular, it's to strengthen the black men, because I think that we don't get enough opportunities for us to really be the focus of, like, improvement. And in order for New Africa to be a shining nation on this planet, men, women, and children who are New African have to all be able to, you know, grow and develop and become better. So my goal is to sort of set out to help the black men do their part.
Okay. Again, I will thank you for coming to our platform and share your knowledge on the stand. I will thank you for the work you're doing in the past, present, and the future. I'd like to make a couple of announcements. You know, we understand that new African political prisoner and elder, Baba Dr. Mutula Shakur, is about to be released. There are various campaigns going online via MAGM, you know what I'm saying, the friends and family of Baba Dr. Where you can donate your time, your resources, and other things of that nature to propagate the information, as well as donate resources. You can find them online. And also, within my local cadre, New African cadre here in Dr. General Clark Town. Before I say that, there's also an event taking place December the 10th in Atlanta that's taking place, which is a concert, which is a fundraiser for Dr. Mutula Shakur, for various rappers from the RBG Outlaws and so forth. So I'm going to be there in regard to raise funds for Dr. Mutula Shakur. That a lot of them also have been influenced by him, such as Zaid Malik and other individuals that have been influenced by him for quite some time, for years and eons, you know. And also, there are other various campaigns going around the state for fundraiser. They'll take place in the West Coast, in Oakland, I think. The one taking place in Detroit. Some taking place in Philly and other places. They'll take also fundraising programs and ideas, as well as you can donate money directly to the campaign themselves. But also on December the 10th in Dr. Jeremy Clark Town, Missionary Columbia, Georgia, we're having a pop-up shop that geared toward new African economics in regards to putting a quote-unquote black dollar back in our pockets, right? So, you know, you can go on our page, be part of Independence, find out more information about it, or you can reach me. And also, for the information about Dr. Mutula Shakur, you go to the Malcolm and Grassroots Movement website, the Malcolm and Grassroots page on social media, or you contact me, I'll give you some information to it.
you know, if you have any close comrades, associates, or little behind enemy lines, if you're looking for Georgia University, you can go on our social media, which is Georgia University on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, get more information, or you contact via email, which is georgiauniversity71@gmail.com. Again, georgiauniversity71@gmail.com. And now we're having a campaign to bring our elders home, our new Revolutionary National Elders home. They've been putting in work for 30 and 40, 50 years, been locked up behind the shoe. Please support that campaign. And with that, I say long live resistance, mm-hmm. and I say free the land.
Free the land. By any means necessary.
I mean necessary.